And now I'm going to introduce John, my good buddy John, to come up and introduce our speaker. Thanks, John.
Thank you, buddy.
You bet.
My name is John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
Real quick, Cheryl G. from Oxnard is our speaker tonight. She's a dear old friend of mine. And today is her 40th anniversary. If we could all sing happy birthday to Cheryl. Birthday to you, happy birthday to you, happy birthday dear Cheryl,
happy birthday to you.
Wow. Right on. So that's what one of those looks like. Wow. This is the best introduction I've ever had, ever. Hi, everybody. My name is Cheryl, and I am an alcoholic. I'm a little overwhelmed, so bear with me while I get through this. I can't think of a better way to spend my 40th anniversary than to be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am so, so, so grateful to be here. I want to thank Kim and John for asking me to be here and for hosting me and just being great friends over the years. You guys have been amazing. I want to thank Gary and Doyleen, who just made it all the way from Burbank. Thank you so much for being here. I want to thank my best friend, Pandora, who has been my ride or die for many, many 37 years. And we have seen a lot of life together, and I want to thank you for being here. And Catherine and Manny coming in from Oxnard, Tijuana, wherever you were. And thank you for being here. I appreciate you guys. And I just want to say that the blessing of having these kind of friendships can be yours. Mm-hmm. And if you're new or you're renewed to Alcoholics Anonymous or you're not sure you belong here, if you drank like us and you did the things we did, you probably do. And, you know, I didn't know when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous really what this thing was all about or what I was going to get. And if you said that this is the life that I would be living today, I would have not believed you. I would have not believed you, because this is not something that I aspired to be or something I aspired to do, you know. And so just a little bit about my story, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I started drinking at a very young age, if you cannot tell. I'm a little bit young still. So, I grew up in a pretty normal family. And, you know, the only thing I can tell you about my childhood that really set me apart from other people is I was incredibly afraid. And I can't explain why or what the things that happened were that made me that way. But from my earliest memories, I was a terrified little kid, and I was always trying to escape. And that just kind of worked its way into a whole lot of other trouble that eventually, when I found alcohol, I found my master pretty quick. My drinking career was fairly short, but it was filled with a lot of drama and a lot of damage. And you know, I didn't know what I didn't know. And so from my first drinking experiences, which were basically drinking at parties, drinking at family get-togethers, you know, curiosity killed the cat, and I just basically, you know, got the effects of alcohol and thought, oh my gosh, you know, this is magic. And it filled something in me that I couldn't do on my own. And so alcohol really was a god of my understanding. And I went from being a pretty normal kid on the outside and doing all the right things to pretty much being a pretty abnormal kid doing all the wrong things in a very short period of time. By the time I was 14 years old, I was a daily drinker. And I was a resourceful kid. And I knew how to lie, steal, cheat, do whatever I needed to do to get what I needed to get. And it was a short road, but it was a hard road. And my life, you know, I think I could have aspired to be a lot of great things, but, you know, my best day was the days that I was drunk beyond recognition. Those were my best memories, was just, you know, as long as I didn't have to feel, think, or do, I was in good shape, you know, and I knew nothing about what alcoholism was. I didn't know that I was afflicted with something that was different from other people. And so, you know, my, you know, I just didn't have an off switch. I guess that's the best way to put it, you know, and I didn't drink like my friends. I didn't drink like my family. You know, people knew how to put it down and walk away, and I didn't. And all I was always the person that was, you know, looking to do more and never being done, you know, the party was never over. You know, I was never done. And what happened for me was from a really early age, I started having all these consequences as a result of my drinking. And, you know, I just wasn't your normal kid. I was, you know, in seventh grade, I was getting suspended from school for having a bottle of vodka in my locker. You know, I just wasn't your normal kid. And, you know, my friends that I was hanging out with were short-lived, you know, and their family would start to get a little bit of wind about who I was and what I was about. And they would say, yeah, I don't think you should hang out with her anymore. I don't think that's a good idea, you know. And I grew up in a upper class, you know, area where there was a lot of money and I didn't have any. And so I became really resourceful and I would learn how to steal at a young age. And so I would go into my friends' homes and I would get into their parents' liquor cabinets and I would, you know, I would get the alcohol I needed and I would hide it in their homes. So when I came back to their house, the alcohol was there where I needed it to be. I mean, you know, it was just crazy. And I didn't understand that I was drinking to overcome an obsession I could not control. You know, I had no idea what was going on. I had no idea that my whole life was being fueled by alcoholism. And I had no control over it. And around 14, late 14, I had a cousin who was getting sober. And she was going to these 12-step meetings for young people. And because of the trouble I was getting in, the family started to push me towards getting, you know, involved in this. And I was like, you know, the heat's on my back. What do I got to do? Whatever, whatever. And so I finally relented and said I would go to one of these meetings. And I didn't have any white light experience. I didn't relate to the people that were there. I didn't understand why anybody would want to give up drinking for that. That's how I felt. And I didn't identify, you know. So I spent about 6 months working on getting the heat off my back. And I will tell you, that if you are an alcoholic and you get sober, there's a good chance that life will get better in a short period of time just because you're not drinking. But then if you have no recovery, alcoholism will find a way and it will come back and it will beat you down with a vengeance. And that's exactly what happened for me. I stayed sober for about 6 months. Things got good. I was doing great. And I was going to these meetings, right? Just showing up, being a body in the seat, right? And, you know, I got a new boyfriend and I got a new, you know, things were going good, right? And we were driving down the road one day in his Pinto or whatever it was. I'm life is good. And the thought comes to me, you know, oh, and they all drank, of course, you know, they were drinking. And I said, you know, if I was a real alcoholic, like these people say they are, I mean, you couldn't really stay sober this long. You know, this is a long, 6 months is a long time, long time. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm not one of them. And it took me about 10 minutes to go from that thought to having a beer in one hand and a bit of something else in the other. And I was off and running because I was not one of you. I did not have the problems you had. I did not have the disease you talked about. I did not identify at all. And I wasn't ready. So it took me a few more months of doing some uncontrolled drinking, because I never controlled my drinking, and doing some pretty heavy damage in the way of family and friends and people that didn't know me and strangers. And you know, I went out with people that I actually had gotten sober with, because, you know, nobody likes a dull party. So let's bring all the sober friends with you. And, you know, it was ugly. And what happened was, is it got me to a place of complete demoralization. I was 15 years old. I was living in a one bedroom apartment with about five other guys and doing what girls like I do when they need to drink. And I can only imagine if I had stayed there and I had continued living that life, that it probably would have been a short one and you would probably have a different speaker tonight. But what happened was, is fortunately I had a mother who was a black belt Al-Anon, didn't know it, never been to an Al-Anon meeting in her life. But she had a really good ability to say no. And when I would leave and want to come back, she would say no. And when I would run out of money and I would need something, she would say no. And when I would call and I would cry, she would say, stay out there till you're done. And she saved my life. She saved my life. And I don't think she even knew really what she was doing or if that was the right thing to do. And I know I broke her heart every day over and over and over again. And, you know, not everybody has great relationships with their family, and I get that. But my parents were good people. They were good, hardworking people. But I made that call and I reached out to them one more time and I asked for help. That one morning I woke up. I had been drinking for about a week. I was sheet white. I weighed about 100 pounds. I don't remember when my last meal was. And I walked into the bathroom and I looked in the mirror and I didn't recognize the person I saw anymore. And, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff going on in that house, and it was pretty crazy, and my life was really spiraling out of control, and I had a moment of clarity. And in that moment of clarity, the first thing I thought of was, call mom, ask for help. Call mom, ask for help. And I walked out of that bathroom, and I made that phone call, and I sat on the couch in front of, you know, a whole lot of stuff that was going to make me feel good. And I had to wait. I had to wait for that ride. I had to wait for that ride to show up. And I asked myself, you really want to do this? And I had doubt. I had a lot of doubt. So I really wasn't sure. Why did I make that phone call? Now she's going to show up. Now I got to explain. Now I got to this. Now I got to that. I got in the car. If you ever find a member of Alcoholics Anonymous or a loved one that's willing to come out of their way to come get you and save your life, get in the car. And I got in the car. And I got taken to a detox, not of my choice. And I got to spend about 3 weeks there. And then the people in charge decided that I was a flight risk and I was in too much danger of relapse and I really needed long-term treatment because I like to do it my way. And so they sent me to a little halfway house in Vegas. Now, I want you to know, the same mom who kept telling me no, who showed up in the car and drove me to detox, showed up that day and drove me to the airport, got on the plane with me, delivered me to the people in Vegas, made sure I got in safe hands, and drove home. And I had a few things that I'd held on to. I went into treatment with just in case, you know. You guys had things like money and, you know, maybe collateral or cars or, you know, houses or bank accounts or things like that. I didn't have any of that kind of stuff. But I was resourceful, and I knew how to steal, so I had a few rings and things on my possession that I was able to keep. And as I'm getting into this station wagon that has shown up to pick me up and take me out to this halfway house in the middle of nowhere, I'm piling into this car with a bunch of other kids, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, this was a bad idea. And what was I thinking? And the further we drove out, the further we got away from the lights of Vegas. And I started thinking, man, that looks really fun. That looks like a good time. What am I doing here? Gosh, I could be in Vegas. I could be having such a good time. And I look down, and I'm wearing this rock on my hand that I know is worth some money and I know is going to give me a good time. And I thought, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do? I thought, you can't do this. You can't do this. And so I took the ring off and it rolled down the window and I chucked it out the window. Somewhere in Vegas is a really, really nice ring on the side of the freeway if you guys ever want to go. But anyways, so I chucked it out the window. I said, okay, I'm committed. I'm doing this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. And by the time I got to the halfway house, I changed my mind again. Oh my God, this was a bad idea. What am I thinking? These people are crazy. I'm going to be stuck in this halfway house with a bunch of kids I don't like. You know, it's smelly. It's a ranch. There's, you know, there's nothing here but a station wagon and a horse. How am I going to get out of here? And so I devised a plan. And that plan was that I didn't know how to hotwire a car, but I was pretty sure I could saddle up a horse and I could ride it. So my plan was that, you know, come daylight, that's what I'm going to do. And so I waited it out for the night, got my backpack, walked out to the stable to get the horse saddled up, and the horse was dead. Now, I don't think God killed the horse. I think it was just his time. But another pretty significant moment of clarity happened at that point, and I ended up staying. My sobriety date, September 28th, 1984, the day I went into treatment. And just about a month later, a horse saved my life again. And I stayed in that halfway house for a few months, and I got kicked out, and I had to come home. In the midst of coming home, unbeknownst to me, for three more years, my family was going through a major transition of buying a business and starting some new things in life. And here comes this train wreck of a kid they've had out of their hair for just long enough for them to make some decisions and do some new things. And here I come back again. And I stay home for about 4 months. I'm stark raving sober. I'm going to meetings and doing nothing else. I have no sponsorship. I have no nothing. And by the time I'm 4 months sober, I'm ready to blow my head off. Just being sober is not going to be enough. If you're an alcoholic like me, you either need to drink or you need recovery. You need the steps. You need a God. You need all of the above, and that's what I needed, and I wasn't getting it. I was going to meetings, but I wasn't getting it. So one more suicide attempt, one more trip to an asylum, and the doctors at the asylum said, just medicate her, she'll be okay. She just needs a little bit of time. So they sent her home with a pill bottle and said, give these to her once a day and come and see me in 30 days. Now, my mom, black belt Al-Anon, she is not about to give her drug-addicted alcoholic kid more drugs for another 30 days and wait and see what happens. So what she decides to do is take all those pills and open all the capsules up, and she pours all the medication, and she fills it up with Cremora, puts them all back together, and that's what she gives me for 30 days. Black belt Al-Anon. Oh, yeah. And you know what? Cremora works great. It worked really good. I've been on medication in my sobriety, and I'm not dissing anybody who's have to go through that. And my heart goes out to you. I've been there. But that was my story in the beginning. And that was my start. And what happened was, as I came back to that young people's program and I went to more meetings and went to more meetings, and somebody said to me one day, you know what, Cheryl, I think you need to be around people who've got longer time sober than you. I think you need to be around people who might have more of a program that you need. And she introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my recovery truly started here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had managed to put together almost a year at that point. And I met a woman in recovery. She was tall, she was blonde, she was beautiful. She wore short shorts and she roller skated all around every meeting I went to, and I loved it. I loved her. And she was exactly what I wanted to be like, and she had everything I wanted, and so I asked her to sponsor me. And one of the first things she did was she pulled out the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you so much. She pulled out the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and she opened it up to a page called They Stopped in Time. And she read my story to me. She talked about those people who maybe didn't go down as far as some of us did, you know, who didn't lose the cars and the money and the families and the things, but lost their self-respect and their dignity and their self-esteem. And I surely lost all of that. And she said, you have a place in Alcoholics Anonymous. We just got to get you going on the steps so you can have a real recovery. And so we started working the process of the steps. And that is where I learned about alcoholism. I learned about how I am different in this unique way in my body, that when I put alcohol in my body, I just don't respond the way other people do. And that's why I couldn't stop once I started. And that's why I couldn't predict when I was going to start, because I'm bodily and mentally different than my fellows. And we wrote out those steps. We wrote out step one. We talked about powerlessness and unmanageability, and we talked about how that looked and showed up in my life. And we talked about what it means to be returned to a sane way of thinking in step two. I didn't always think that that's what step two meant. I thought that, you know, it meant you were going to learn how to pick the right boyfriend and get the right job and not make stupid mistakes anymore. And step two is strictly about being restored to sanity when it comes to drinking. And that was news for me. She introduced me to a God I did not know or understand. I had no religious background. I had no training in any form in that way. And she asked me, you know, what do you believe? And I said, I don't have a belief. I don't know God. I don't understand God. And she said, well, you know, what feels right to you? What do you feel like you connect with? And I said, well, I connect with you guys. I mean, the light in your eyes, the life that you're living, the hope that you have, I can believe in that. And the group became my higher power and was my higher power for many years. And I'm so grateful for the sponsorship that I had. She was able to love me and nurture me to a point where eventually I was able to believe in something greater than myself, something greater than you guys. And I did my first four step. A written four step was the first time I had ever been totally, completely honest with another human being about my life. And it was scary. It was really, really scary. But the one thing she kept telling me was, don't stop. Whatever you do, you start this inventory, do not stop writing. Finish it, get done with it, and let's move on. And that's so important. And if you've ever had the honor and privilege of listening to another human being's fifth step, she did mine that day. Please don't ever take that out of confidence. I have heard so many stories of people sharing somebody's inventory at meeting level or just with good intentions on the side, and it can be devastating for that person, you know? That never happened to me, and I'm grateful for that. So she heard that fifth step, and then she told me that we were going to talk about character defects and shortcomings. I had some. Who knew? Being a liar and terrified all of my life was probably my biggest defects that showed up. And, you know, she kept telling me that there was hope for change. She said there was a God that was greater than all of that that could help guide me back into, you know, a safe place in myself where I didn't have to be that person anymore. And then we got into all of the people that I had harmed. And you would think that that list was kind of short because I was so young. It wasn't short. There was a lot of people on that list that I had harmed. And some of them I haven't even been able to connect with yet today. But they are on my list and I'm willing and ready. One of the most significant amends that I made in my sobriety was to my stepdad. My stepdad had been in my life since I was 3 years old and always treated me like his daughter, always. He never called me a stepdaughter. He never acted as though I was different than any of the other kids. And around 8 years old, I had a visit with my real dad. And during that time, my real dad asked me a question. He said, do you love your dad? And I said, which one? It was an honest question. It was an honest answer. I had two dads. Which one? And he said, you only have one dad. And you will only love one dad. And that is one of my first greatest resentments that I can recall, and something that I wrote in my inventory. And from that point on, from 8 years old until well after I got sober, I treated that man less than. I treated him with disrespect in his home, living under the same roof. And after several years, I just stopped talking to him altogether. He helped me get sober. He paid for my treatment. He kept a roof over my head. And he kept the door open when I came home. How do you make amends for that? And so she said, we're going to do what's called a living amends, Cheryl. You're going to act differently. So my instructions were to come home, and every day I was supposed to say hello. I was supposed to acknowledge his presence. So every day I would come home, and I would say, hello, Carl. And the first one was really surprising. I mean, his eyebrows went up, he was like, what's going on? And that started the healing. And then it turned into, how are you doing? How is your day? How are things going? And the months turned into years, and we developed a really, really beautiful relationship. About 3 years into my sobriety, we were sitting down talking one day at the table, and my dad surprised me. He said, do you know what today is? And I said, no, what's today? And he says, today is our anniversary. I said, what do you mean, our anniversary? And he says, today is the day that you came home and said hello to me. Never, ever, ever doubt the power that amends can make. That was a relationship I wasn't sure I would heal. And it was by faith and trust in a power greater than myself that I was willing to take the steps necessary to humble myself and make that right. And there have been many, many other relationships that have been healed as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. One of the other ones was, I have several siblings, but I have one brother in particular who was one of us, had struggled for many years, was a destitute alcoholic, had tried really, really hard to get sober at one time. But he would call me in the middle of the night, and he would be drunk, and we were disconnected for many years. And I just kind of got tired of getting the phone calls and hearing the drunk stories and, you know, him telling me who I should marry and that some guy isn't good enough for me or whatever his story was. And I just got tired of hearing it. And I said, you know what? I don't want your calls anymore. Just stop calling. If you're going to be drunk, just stop calling. So he did. And so years later, I decided that was not the right way to handle my alcoholic brother. And so I hired a company and I found him. And he was going through a hard time. He had lost a job. He was drinking. He couldn't get sober. He was trying, but he couldn't get sober. And I said, you know, I made a big mistake a lot of years ago, and I told you I didn't want to hear from you anymore, and that just wasn't true. And I wanted to call you and tell you that I love you, and that you mean the world to me, and that I am sober, and that there is hope for you. And if you want to go to a meeting, I will get you to a meeting. And he did the nicest thing he could, and he said, thank you, I really appreciate that. And I'll let you know when I'm ready. And in 2001, On June 7th, my brother killed himself. And he will never, ever know the life that we have here and the hope that we have here and what is possible. But the amends gave me peace. The amends healed what couldn't be healed otherwise. Alcoholics Anonymous has done so many incredible, amazing things for me. And this God that is so big that I didn't understand keeps showing up over and over and over again. And I'm so grateful for the people who have come before me and paved the path and shown me that I can keep going, because long-term sobriety is not for sissies, let me tell you. You think 30 days was hard. but one of the most beautiful things is that I have a story filled with imperfection. I have a story filled with mistake after mistake after mistake. I mean, just my two husbands alone. But I do have three amazing kids. I have four great grandkids, you know, and I'm really, really blessed to be their mom. I'm really blessed to be a sober mom that they have never seen drunk. But they have seen stark raving sober. And, you know, stark raving sober happens when you just are so darn busy and you can't get to your meeting this week. And, you know, your sponsor just doesn't want to hear this stuff again. And, you know, neither do your friends. And so, you know, you just, you know, I'll get to it later. I'll call them later. You know, I'll go to a meeting next week. I'll, you know, no, I don't want to be on that committee right now. I got so much going, you know, the kids and everything. I got so much going on. I just don't have time. Pretty soon, you're working in a bar. You're hanging out with a cocaine dealer. I mean, you know, I'm just living on the edge a little bit. It's okay. You know, the kids are fine. And one more time, the insanity returns. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning and I'm sitting in another Pinto and I'm waiting for the drug dealer to come back. You know, and even though I'm sober, I am sober. I am dry. I am crispy, crispy, crispy dry. And I am in serious need of God or a drink. And the only thing I can think of was, you know what? The only thing he's got for me is, you know, a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So when he comes back, I'm going to tell him to line that right up on the dash and I'm going to be good. And something happened in that time between the time he was gone and the time he came back, that another moment of clarity happened and God came home. And when he got back in the car, I said, I need you to take me back right now. I need out of here right now. And I ran back to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I got honest about where I was at. And the truth was I was about 10 years sober and I had worked my steps and I was going to meetings and I had a home group and I had a sponsor and I looked like I was doing all the right things, but on the inside, I wasn't, you know, and on the inside, I needed a drink. And my sponsor asked me, how many people are you working with? How many people are you sponsoring right now? Are you getting out of yourself? Are you calling anybody? Are you at? I'm like, I'm busy. I got stuff to do. I got kids. I got a husband. I got a job. I don't have time for sponsees. She says, you better make time. So at about 10 years sober, I finally started being of service. I finally started giving back. And I started sharing my experience, strength, and hope with other people, other women. And I started giving back and I started sponsoring more and more and more. And my life got really, really good. I started to learn a whole new side of Alcoholics Anonymous I didn't even know existed, you know, because I wasn't fully a part of it. And I guarantee you, if you're hitting a low spot, if you're having doubt, if you're having some, you know, trial, a tribulation, whatever it is that's going on in your life, I'm telling you, there is a solution here, you know. And sometimes it is outside help, and sometimes it is, you know, having to do other things. But you know what? The baseline of Alcoholics Anonymous, the foundation that I have built here, has never failed me. Never. And sponsorship became my greatest gift in Alcoholics Anonymous. Service became my greatest gift. And I learned more about myself and giving back than I ever knew before, you know, and the gift that I had was I had great sponsorship and I had a thirst for learning, and I was willing to sit down and actually read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with other people. And, you know, it changed my whole life. I got to be in general service. I got new commitments, and, I started to feel that thing that people talk about. I think they call it integrity. You know, I stopped seeing myself as this punk kid in Alcoholics Anonymous who was just kind of rummaging through life trying to figure things out all the time. And I started to have this spiritual experience, you know. Something about me changed, and I was truly growing up. I was truly growing up in Alcoholics Anonymous. But there is one thing that I am sure about to this day, to this moment, that I can say with conviction, and that is that I remember who I am as an alcoholic, as a practicing alcoholic, like it was 5 seconds ago. I remember my last drink, and I remember the person I was and the things that I would do. I remember having no conscience, no concern, no care for another human being whatsoever. If you were in my way, that was bad for you, and you better get quick about it. And, you know, I know, I have no illusions about the fact that if I were to pick up today, or I would get too far away, stray too far away from Alcoholics Anonymous, the person that I would become, and I have a lot to lose. So if you're here, and you're new, or you're renew, or you're on the fence, I'm going to give you the best advice that any of us can give you. Jump in with both feet. Don't be the doubting Thomas, and stay. Thank you.
That was fantastic. Thank you, Cheryl. Let's give everyone another round of applause. Also like to thank the residents of the house and the kitchen staff for a fantastic dinner. Thank you. And we can now close in the usual manner with a prayer of Cheryl's choice. Thank you.